Hello, everybody. Now, you remember last time we were talking about, when we were talking about Plato, I mentioned there were two questions I was going to ask about all the different people I'm talking about. So two questions we can use to concentrate on the whole subject of political thought. And the questions were, what does the particular writer say about individual rights? Does he have the notion of individual rights? Or if he does, what does he say about them? And also, what does the writer say about whether people are obligated to obey the state? Should there be a state in our people obligated to obey it? And from a libertarian point of view, Plato, whom we talked about last week, didn't do all that well. Remember, Plato is concerned the Republic with justice, and he, in particular, trying to reply to the challenge posed by Glaucon and Adeimantus, who say, can you show that it's being just is a good thing in itself, by which they meant, can you show that being just will in itself make one happy? Not just, not only does being just lead to good consequences, we could imagine in the way that Glaucon suggests, we can have a certain arrangement by where everybody agrees to obey certain rules, like not to steal, not to kill other people. So if everybody obeys those rules, we'll all be better off. But there, it doesn't seem like we're valuing justice for its own sake. We're saying it's good that people observe these rules, because that doing so will make people better off. We're not saying that justice is itself a good. And so, as we saw last week, what Plato meant by that was, we want to show, if we can, that justice makes people happy. And Plato took that very strong sense and said, well, just exactly what it is to be happy is to be just. And how would he show that? It seems like kind of an odd proposition. How would being just constitute happiness? The way he argued for that was, what he defined justice as the right ordering of the soul. So if your soul or mind was rightly ordered, the reason would control your emotions and also your will. The will is what executes your decision. So the reason would be in control, and he thought that was justice and also happiness. And then he constructs an ideal city, which he calls Kallipolis, on this line where we have the guardians, who are philosopher kings representing reason, who are ruling the whole city. And everybody else has to do as they direct, because just as reason in the soul is directing the will and the appetites, let alone the body, reason in the state, represented by the philosophers, is controlling the city. So you see, from a libertarian point of view, Plato, as I say, doesn't do all that well. He doesn't really have the notion of individuals having rights against the state. To the contrary, he's assuming a very strong state in which the philosophers who are representing reason can tell everybody else what to do. Now, the person we'll be talking about today, Aristotle, as we'll see, where he fits into this point about these questions on individual rights is very much disputed, although, as we'll see, he also believes in a government or state that people have ought to obey, but whether he believes there is a case to be made, and we'll see how that goes, that he did have a notion of individual rights, unlike Plato, although as we'll see, that's disputed. And first I want to say a few words about Aristotle's biography. Aristotle lived from 384 to 322 BC, so as you can imagine, there are very few people now living who knew Aristotle personally. Most people don't live over 1,000 years anymore, so we probably don't have any people who remember Aristotle. And Aristotle was born in the city-state of Macedon, which is, of course, you know, Philip of Macedon is the king, and his son Alexander the Great, one of the most famous people in antiquity, was from there. Aristotle was born in the city of Stagira in Macedon, sometimes called the Stagirae, because he was born in Macedon. It doesn't mean he was somebody who staggered, just he was born in that city. So what's very important to remember here is that Aristotle, unlike Plato, who was from a very aristocratic Athenian family, was not an Athenian. And he lived, when he lived in Athens, he was there in two periods. First, he studied at Plato's Academy. Remember, the Academy was the school founded by Plato. So he lived there, and then later on, when Philip of Macedon defeated the Athenians and set up a provincial governor under his control as the ruler of Athens, or in charge of Athens, Aristotle came back to the city, and then he was there also. And then when there was a revolt against that, governor Aristotle got out of the city. He said, well, he supposedly said we wouldn't want there to be a crime against philosophy twice, meaning he was afraid that people would kill him just the way Socrates had been killed. So Aristotle lived as a non-resident alien, which is called a metic, M-E-T-I-C, in Athens. And, you remember which figure, does anyone remember who in Plato's Republic is a metic, a non-resident alien? But I mentioned this in the lecture last week. Does anyone remember that? It was the old rich old man, Cephalus. So he was also a medic. So Aristotle's father was the court physician to Philip of Macedon. And according to most accounts, Aristotle was a tutor to Philip's son, Alexander the Great, although it's disputed how much contact he had with him. He apparently taught him for a couple of years, but what he taught him and how close they were is disputed. Aristotle doesn't mention him in his book Politics, so he really doesn't say much about Alexander. And as I said before, Aristotle studied with Plato at the Academy, and in one of the most famous battles of antiquity, it's called the Battle of Chaeronea, Philip defeated the Athenian. I already went through this. He set up a provincial government, and as I mentioned just a short time ago, he had to leave. He left when a revolt broke out. He didn't want to be killed. So you see the contrast with Socrates is portrayed by Plato. Remember, when Socrates is condemned to death by the Athenian assembly, he had a chance to escape, but he refuses because he said, well, life without outside the city is unthinkable to him. But Aristotle was not a citizen of Athens, so it was perfectly all right as far as he was concerned to live somewhere else. Now, Dan says, did Aristotle also tutor Ptolemy the Great? Well, I'd have to check into that. I'm not familiar with that claim, but it is an interesting speculation, but I have to look into that. So while Aristotle was in Athens, when he came back under this provincial governor set up by Philip of Massa, he founded his own school called the Lyceum. Remember, Plato School is the academy, so Aristotle says he's going to found his own school called Lyceum. The academy was still around, but Aristotle wanted his own school. Now, Aristotle didn't originate the name Lyceum. It was the gymnasium in a public meeting place in Athens that was there a long time before the school. So Aristotle named his school after this public place. It's just like, say, the Mises Institute is located at Auburn University. Auburn University is the name of the school, and it's in a town called Auburn. So in a similar way, the Lyceum is the name for Aristotle's school, and it's in a part of Athens that's called the Lyceum. Now, Aristotle wrote a great many books. He was, in addition to the philosopher, he was a great scientist. He's one probably the greatest biologist in antiquity. But the two books that he wrote that are relevant to this course, that are relevant to political thought, are the Nicomachean Ethics and the Politics. Now, just one point. Notice the way Nicomachean is spelled in English. It's N-I-C-O. You'll see in certain books, unfortunately, it's called N-I-C-H. That's wrong. It's N-I-C-O. And Nicomachus was Aristotle's son, who named the book after it. There's also another book on ethics called the Eudemian Ethics that he wrote, but most scholars think the Nicomachean Ethics is the more important of the two. There's Sir Anthony Kenny, who's one who dissents from that, but most people say the Nicomachean Ethics is the main one, his main book on ethics. And one thing that you'll notice is very similar to Plato. Remember when I was talking about Plato, I had quite a bit to say, I hope you don't think too much to say, about Plato's view of morality, of why should individuals be just, and then I went into what Plato has to say about the ideal city, Kallipolis. So here with Aristotle, it's similar. There's a very close connection between Aristotle's views on ethics and politics. And at the end of the Ethics, Aristotle says that the good of human beings require that they live in a city, so that people can't really make it on their own and live a good life. So ethics for him is thus part of politics, because politics is what tells you how to live in a good city. So that's the more comprehensive discipline of which ethics is a part. Now, Aristotle's method of proceeding is an interesting one, which he uses in both the Ethics and Politics. What he does is he doesn't just give his own ideas. He just, well, say you're writing on ethics, so he said, well, here's my theory of the good, and then just start going into that. Aristotle doesn't do it that way. What he does is he starts from commonly accepted beliefs of well-brought-up people. So he said, let's start from generally accepted beliefs, beliefs that well-brought-up people hold, and then we can go on from there. So he'll start criticizing and developing his own ideas from the commonly accepted beliefs, but you don't just start with your own idea. So this is a bit different, remember, from the Socratic dialogue. What Socrates does is he'll start with something that someone says, and then he'll try to destroy it, the famous Socratic dialectic, just kind of try to knock out what people are saying. So Aristotle doesn't do that. Aristotle more builds on commonly accepted beliefs, so sometimes criticize them, but he isn't trying to refute them. And it's very much not, say, like Descartes proceeds in the Meditations, where he said, well, he's going to doubt everything and then just start with some proposition that can't be doubted and try to deduce things from that. Aristotle is starting from common sense or ordinary beliefs. And in pursuit of that project where you're starting from the common sense or ordinary belief, Aristotle or his students, it's uncertain who did this, compiled a list of Greek constitutions. The constitution, I don't mean a formal document like the U.S. Constitution. The Constitution would just be a description of the basic rules in the city. Now let's see, Dan's pointing out, that's right, a lot of the opinions of the pre-Socratic philosophers are preserved by Plato's and Aristotle's passages in the Japanese. Yes, Aristotle was really the first important historian of philosophy, and a lot of what we know about the older philosophy comes from Aristotle's descriptions. Now, as I say, Aristotle started from the beliefs about ethics and politics of well-brought-up people. But isn't this a problem? Because how do we know who the well-brought-up people are? Suppose we say, well, the well-brought-up people are the ones who come up with pretty close to the right views about ethics and politics. So that presupposes we already know what the right views are, but just what we're trying to do is find out what the correct views are. So how, if you say we're starting from the beliefs of the well-brought-up people, how do we know who are those people? And what would happen, say, if we tried to do that today? Suppose we said, well, we're going to take the beliefs of the people who consider the highly educated to be elite people today. So libertarianism might not do so well because libertarians don't believe in government schools or public education, but some people say, well, everyone knows we need public education. So if you follow this method where you're just assuming that the elites are the well-brought-up people, then you see how libertarians wouldn't do well. In fact, this is a criticism Hillary Putnam raised of Robert Nozick. He said, well, you know, a great libertarian philosopher was his colleague at Harvard. He said, look, Nozick's here impliedly shouldn't have public education, but everybody knows we need this. So see, I'm raising this just to show kind of this general problem, a little problem with how Aristotle is proceeding, that if you say we're starting with what well-brought-up people believe, it's skewing the answers in a certain way. It's a bit, the chrism I'm raising, a bit like the chrism that's sometimes raised of John Rawls, the famous author of Theory of Justice, which came out in 1971, what he called reflective equilibrium. So what Rawls suggests is that what we do is we have certain beliefs, certain moral beliefs, and then we have theories about them. What we should try to do is modify our theories and beliefs so they all fit each other. So, say we have a certain theory about morality, and then we test this out by how it fits in ordinary moral judgment. We kind of adjust one to the other so they all fit. So, an objection to this is, well, maybe we're just making our own view systematic in that way. We're trying to get our own views to be coherent. But how do we know these views are true? Just because our views fit together doesn't show they're true. So you can see perhaps there's a problem in the way Aristotle is proceeding. Now, there's one of the top scholars on both Aristotle's Plato is Terence Irwin, who's at Cornell, and he has a very long book called Aristotle's First Principles. And what he says is that he replies to the Stoicism. He says, well, Aristotle didn't stop with our commonly held beliefs. So Aristotle didn't say, okay, we've got these commonly held beliefs of the well-brought up people, all we have to do is get them into systematic form. He said this is just part of what Aristotle was doing. This is what he calls weak dialectic. But according to Irwin, Aristotle tests these ideas against certain metaphysical principles that he independently develops. And this is what he calls strong dialectic. So the way Aristotle would reply to the criticism I've been trying to give, which is, in the assuming that we already have the truth about ethics or politics, if we're just systematizing what people or certain people believe, Irwin's answer is, well, he doesn't stop there. He tries, after he does that kind of systematic arrangement of people's beliefs, then he develops his own independent views and tries to show whether these beliefs are correct. Now, how does he proceed to do that? What is this kind of independent metaphysical argument he uses, independent philosophical argument he uses, other than starting with people's beliefs? Well, one point he makes will be very familiar to people who study Mises and human action. Maybe Aristotle had read Mises because he said something very similar. He said something the same. He said, every action, anything we do, has a goal or end. So suppose I say I'm now giving a lecture or you're listening to my lecture. We could say, why am I doing that? Why are you listening? We could always add that advantage of it. It's called the final cause, the end or goal. Now, suppose I say, well, I'm giving this lecture because I want to teach certain ideas about political thought. So that's my goal. That's why I'm giving a lecture. I want to convey certain ideas about what Aristotle thought. So we could go on to ask, why do we want this? Why do I want to teach this? And then I can answer that by giving another goal. What would be the goal of my communicating information about teaching things about political thought to you? Why would I do that? And so, according to Aristotle, well, I can't just keep doing that indefinitely. I can't say, what is the, say I have a certain goal or end, and say, well, why do I do that? And say, give some example, why do I do that? I can't go on indefinitely. I can't have a never-ending series of ends. There has to be an ultimate end, which is an end that doesn't have a further goal, just that's it. So the series has to have a stopping point, because otherwise, imagine just one, I do this to achieve this goal, I have a further end in mind for this, the goal, and that goes indefinitely, I never have any real grounding for an action. It would just be everything is in pursuit of some other goal, but I'd never be able to establish a real end for the action. Everything would be just to achieve something else. And to Aristotle, this doesn't make sense. Now, some people think that Robert Nozick was one who raised this objection, but a lot of people have raised this objection to Aristotle. They say when he reasoned this way, he was committing he was guilty of a logical fallacy. So what is supposed to be the fallacy? Well, he's reasoning from each action there must be a stopping point in the series of ends. So this is just what we've been saying before. You can't have an infinite series of goals. Goal A is to achieve goal B to achieve goal C, and just keep going, and when we run out of letters, we just keep putting in some other symbols, and just keep going on indefinitely. So that's also, well, the series has to come to a stop. So that isn't fallacious. That seems pretty acceptable to say, well, we can't have an infinite series of goals, but according to people who say Aristotle committed a fallacy, he wrongly concludes there's an ultimate end that all actions aim at. So what he starts in the premise of each action has a stopping point, and he's concluding there's a stopping point that all actions aim at. Now, sometimes when you're trying to understand an argument, it helps if you can come up with a parallel argument or an analogous argument where you can see what the problem is. And one example I like to give that I think shows what the problem is, suppose we start with the premise every person has a father. So this is like each action has a stopping point or ultimate goal. So every person has a father. You can see how every person has a father is like every action has a stopping point. So every person has a father does not imply some person is everyone's father. That's a false statement. A person would have to be pretty busy to be everybody's father. He'd have to be his own father. So you can see what the problem is, that if you say every action has a goal, that's true. It doesn't follow that the goal is the same for every action. Just saying whenever you have an action, you have a goal for that action that isn't, for which there's no further goal, you see. So there's an ultimate goal for each action, but it doesn't follow they all have to be the same ultimate goals. You could have different ones for different actions. You have different stopping points, just as you say every person has a father, it doesn't imply there's some person who's everybody's father. Now, Aristotle had an answer to this objection, and what he said was, well, suppose, or what these people reconstructed his argument in this way, they say, suppose there are multiple final end. Let's say, well, here is a series of goals that ends this way. Here's another series that ends a different way. But we don't have a single goal that's the goal of every action. So Aristotle says, well, suppose we have these multiple final ends. We can ask, how are those ends related? And if we're following the reason, these ultimate goal ends should be systematically related rather than haphazard. So we wouldn't want to say, well, turns out the ultimate goal here is making money, the ultimate goal here is studying philosophy, the ultimate goal here is something else. We wouldn't want to just leave it at that. We want to arrange all these ultimate goals in a systematic way. So how did Aristotle propose to do that? How is he going to arrange all these goals in a systematic way? Well, here he's, again, notice how Irwin is right here, that Aristotle is using certain metaphysical principles that he holds to help him solve problems in ethics. So one principle he held was that every substance, a substance is something that's independently existing, like each of you is a substance, an individual substance, because you exist, or say something like your height, how tall you are, isn't a substance, because your height can't exist just by itself. It's a property or modification of you. You remember Lewis Carroll's joke, I think it's in Alice in Wonderland, where Alice sees the Cheshire Cat grinning, and then everything disappears of the cat except the grin. See, the joke there is a grin, the facial expression, couldn't exist by itself. It's just a modification of the substance, which is the cat. So Aristotle said, every substance, everything that can exist by itself has an essence. But the essence is something like the structure of the thing. What are the defining characteristics of the thing? What, say, if you say mammals have to be warm-blooded, so being warm-blooded would be part of the essence of being a mammal. So every substance has, according to Aristotle, has an essence, and everything has a tendency in nature to realize its essence, to achieve its essence. Here again we can use the notion that Danny mentioned, the final cause, the end or the goal of something's activity. So everything has a tendency to realize its essence, to attain its defining properties. For example, suppose you take the seeds of a plant, they have a natural tendency to develop, so they realize the plant's nature. So how is this going to help us in ethics? Well, according to Aristotle, human beings are different from all other natural entities. That, say, a tree does, or seeds don't have any choice of whether they're going to develop into a tree. If you take an acorn, its natural tendency is to develop into an oak tree. It's not going to develop into a pear tree or a cat or anything else other than what its essence requires. But human beings are different because human beings have the choice whether to act in accord with their nature or not. And those of you who read Ayn Rand will know this is very much along the lines that she said, that she said, well, we have a choice to live or to die, to act in accord with our nature as a rational being or not. So evidently, besides reading Mises, Aristotle read Rand as well. wonder how he was able to read these books that were written so much later than his own life. Makes you stop and wonder. That was a joke. You're supposed to laugh at this point. All right. So, suppose we know human beings, like everything else, have a nature, and we have a choice of whether to act according to that nature. Well, that's all very well, but how do we know what the nature is? How do we find out what this nature is? According to Aristotle, the way we find out the nature of something is to say, what is the unique characteristic of a thing? So, suppose you're saying, well, what is the nature of a mammal? You would say, what are the properties of a mammal that other things that are non-mammals don't have? So, we get warm-blooded is one of these. So, according to Aristotle, what's uniquely human is reason. That human beings can reason in a way that other animals are much less non-objects that aren't animals at all can't reason. So, I could give a lecture on Aristotle, but say a dog or cat couldn't. So here again, there's an objection, and this is one that knows it raises. I just see, let me just read what Danny said, something like Menger's in the higher order. Good. Yes, I think there is an interesting parallel you draw. Maybe we can go into that more in the discussion. But let's get back to Nozick's objection, which is, why is uniqueness so important? Supposing we found out, let's say, there's some other creature that can also reason, supposing dolphins are much more rational than we thought, that dolphins could, if they wanted to, give a lecture on Aristotle, just don't want to bother. Would that change the essence of human beings? What's the big deal about uniqueness? Or suppose it just turned out that human beings are the only animal that laughs. Would that make being able to laugh such an essential, the essence of human being, what's so important about uniqueness? So here I think the response is that Aristotle was concerned not with uniqueness as such, not just what is something that human beings have that no other entity has, but he was concerned with what characteristic best explains people other than, besides saying it's something that other entities don't have, he was saying, what best explains people? That was primary in his thought, and this is why he picked reason. He thought, if you take human beings as rational animals, that will enable you to get a better understanding of them than if you took some other properties. So then, okay, suppose we know that reason is the defining characteristic of human beings' nature. Now, how does this help us when we're trying to figure out how these goals, every action will have a stopping point, but we want to know how do all these stopping points relate to each other? So he says, well, we can't systematize them in the way that we want to say, well, they all are aiming at pleasure of some sort, because there are all different kinds of pleasure, sensory pleasures, intellectual pleasure. So he said, pleasure is unsystematic, so this wouldn't give you really a rational arrangement of ultimate ends. And also, pleasure is dependent on outside forces, if, say, you're feeling good or bad. That'll depend on all sorts of things in your the environment, and it's not really under your own control. So he said, pleasure isn't the ultimate end. Now, well, what is? Well, he says, what are we trying to do? We're trying to figure out how these different ends that we have are related. And he says, just that activity of trying to figure out how these ends of ours are related is itself the way the ends are related. Just the attempt to systematize them is the systematic arrangement. Just that activity, just thinking about how the ends are arranged, is a case of rational arrangement of the activities. So it's sort of a reflexive, it's applying to itself, it's saying, how do we know what the ultimate end is? Well, it's just thinking about how these ends are to be organized. And so this is what's called the inclusive end interpretation of Aristotle, because saying the ultimate end is thinking about how all the various ends are related to each other. So it's inclusive, like it's called inclusive, including all the ends, it's trying to arrange them systematically, and just that activity is the ultimate end. Now another, there's another interpretation that is found, especially people emphasize book 10 of the Ethics, and this stresses philosophical contemplation, just thinking about various philosophical problems like the nature of being would be the highest good. So this is a little different from the inclusive end interpretation, but they're not completely apart, because inclusive end is a type of philosophical contemplation. Now someone raised a question, well, is the act of arranging, which is endless, well, it's the activity of arranging is the goal, so it wouldn't be, once you grasp that, it wouldn't be endless, because you would see that itself is the goal, namely thinking about how the other ends are to be arranged. It might be you wouldn't come to firm conclusions about what the arrangement should be, but it wouldn't be an endless process, because you would see just that thinking about the arrangement is itself the ultimate goal. That's a bit convoluted, but I think you can see what Aristotle is saying. So, okay, well, that gives you the ultimate end, but then we also have, in ethics, we have certain, ethics, after all, isn't just a theory of the ultimate end, the goal. It discusses certain habits, certain types of behavior that we have that are called virtues, like courage or temperance. So Aristotle has a discussion now of the types of virtues. So first, he divides virtues into theoretical and practical. We'll be concerned here with practical virtues, which are the ones that are dealing with action. So the supreme practical virtue is called phronesis, which is the principle that organizes the other virtues, such as courage and temperance. So just like with the, we talk about the ends, we get that the highest end is how we're organizing all the ends. Here the highest virtue is what organizes the other virtues, what gives each of the other virtues its proper place. And then he has a very famous view about virtue. He said, a virtue is a mean between two extremes. What does this mean? He says, well, for every virtue, we'll see there's an exception to this, he says, there are vices on either side of the virtue. For example, suppose we say somebody is courageous. this, say, someone, imagine what the exactly courageous person, say, you're, imagine you're walking along, you see there's a fire and there's someone trapped in a building, so you go in and rescue them, so you're overcoming your fear and you're showing your courage by rescuing the person. So, having an example of courage now, we could distinguish that, say, imagine somebody is foolhardy. Let's say the person sees a burning building, he remembers he left a penny in the building. So he runs in the building, try to rescue the penny. So we say, well, isn't that, he's not showing how courageous he is. He might show he doesn't have much fear, but it's very foolish to do that, to risk your life just for a penny. And on the other hand, suppose his family is trapped in the building and he could rescue them pretty easily, but he's just too scared to do it. So we would say he's cowardly. You see, the virtue is, courage is a mean between the two vices of foolhardiness or rashness and cowardice. Now, one mistake that's sometimes made here is when he says that the virtue is a mean between two extremes, this doesn't mean that if you shouldn't exert yourself fully or be enthusiastic, it doesn't mean you shouldn't get excited about things, but it's just that virtue stands between two vices. So he's not saying something like, well, don't really get excited or don't lose your cool, just always act calmly. That isn't what he's saying, it's just that the virtue stands between two vices. And he says there's an exception to this, that the virtue of justice isn't a mean between two vices. So there isn't something like being too extreme in the pursuit of justice. Now, this Aristotelian point actually played a role in an American presidential campaign. Probably most of you will be too young to remember this, but I remember it very well. In the 1964 presidential campaign, in which Barry Goldwater ran against Lyndon Johnson, Goldwater was considered by many people a very right-wing person. He made his acceptance speech at a Republican convention, a statement, extremism in the defense of liberty is not a vice, and moderation in the pursuit of justice is not a virtue. So this, when he said that, it was actually written by one of the speechwriters, Harry Jaffa, who was an Aristotle scholar. And he was putting in, he had put this in, so Goldwater was making an Aristotelian point, but it wasn't really appropriate for the political campaign. Now, I see there's a question, it couldn't just be a mean between vigilantism and lawlessness. Well, that's an interesting suggestion, but I don't think you want to say a vigilante is just someone who's pursuing justice too much. A vigilante would be acting in a way that's not in accord with proper procedure at all. It wouldn't be that he loves justice too much, but he would be doing wrong things. He would be getting rid of certain criminals, but he wouldn't be doing that in a proper way. So it's an interesting suggestion. I have to think about it more, but it doesn't seem like it would just be you're overly pursuing justice here. You would be, like, vigilante, you're doing it in the wrong way. Now, here we want to raise the point where we're going to be dealing with just the questions. Remember, the key questions in our course are, do the people we talk about have a concept of individual life? That's one of the key questions. So we could make a case from what we've said so far about ethics that maybe Aristotle does have such a view. Well, I guess he wanted, I don't want to get too distracted from my lecture. I see someone suggests justice the mean between tyranny and anarchy. Well, you see, the problem with that sort of thing is you could come up with things that sort of tyranny is too much of something and anarchy is not enough of something, but we want to say, what is it that it's not enough of? Or what is it that there's too much of? And that I think you'd have trouble answering. Tyranny is bad, and I mean anarchy in the sense of chaos is bad also, but what would be the common factor there that tyranny is too much of and anarchy or chaos is too little of? I think you'd have problems there. But the way we try to get an argument for a libertarian Aristotle is to say, well, supposing we say each person is trying to achieve a rational life, everyone's, according to Aristotle, you're supposed to use your phronesis, this principle of practical reason, to organize all the other virtues, and you're supposed to develop all these virtuous habits. So don't we need freedom in order to do this, in order to organize your life? So you have an Aristotelian argument for the importance of freedom or liberty, and two Aristotelian, contemporary Aristotelian philosophers, the two Dougs, Doug Rasmus and Doug Denial, a very good book they had some years ago called Norms of Liberty, give an argument just like that. They said, well, we want to achieve a rational life along the lines of being virtuous and organizing our lives rationally. To do that, we need freedom. Now, I think this is a very good argument, but isn't the way Aristotle goes. We can see this in the Politics. He mentions the view of Lycophron. Lycophron is one of the Sophists. Remember, Sophists are professional teachers of rhetoric or persuasion. So Lycophron says, the polis, or the city-state, exists just for, only for justice and protection. So he's somewhat like a limited state libertarian. So Aristotle says, well, no, that's wrong, because the polis exists so people can live well. So it isn't just for justice and protection. So he's thinking the government has a bigger role than just keeping order and allowing people the freedom to lead their own lives, to organize their lives rationally as they see fit. So Aristotle isn't going that way, but we could come up with an Aristotelian argument for a libertarian view if we emphasize freedom in this way. It isn't really the way Aristotle goes. Now, there's another interpretation of Aristotle. I was giving this libertarian view. Now, there's another view that says, well, no, Aristotle not only wasn't a libertarian, but he was really a collectivist, the opposite of a libertarian. And what those people appeal to, he says that the polis, the city-state, is prior to the individual. He gives the analogy, we'll say, the hand is part of the body. So I'm holding up my hand. This is part of my body. And imagine, I wouldn't like supposing somebody chopped my hand off. So then Aristotle said, well, imagine the chopped off hand. That's not a very pleasant image, but say we imagine it. He said it wouldn't really be a hand. It would just be what used to be a hand. It only exists if it's part of a body. So here Aristotle saying individuals only exist as part of the city. Well, this doesn't sound like a very individualist view at all. And in a famous book that came out on the end of World War II by Karl Popper, called The Open Society's Enemies, the first volume, Popper attacked Aristotle as a collectivist. I remember Hayek, Friedrich Hayek, told me he agreed with Popper in attacking, condemning Plato. He thought Popper had been too hard on Aristotle. But Popper thought Aristotle was really collectivist because he's saying, look, the individual is subordinate to the city. And two great 19th century scholars, Edward Seller, the German historian of philosophy, and George Grote, English historian of Greek philosophy, both great scholars of Greek philosophy, thought that Aristotle's politics resembled Plato's laws. That was a dialogue we didn't discuss last week, but the laws, Plato's laws, it gives an account of a different city called Magnesia, not Milk of Magnesia, but Magnesia, it's a different city from Callipolis. Magnesia is a different city. In most interpreters of the law have said, well, this is a very rigid society. It certainly wouldn't be anything like a libertarian society. So if Aristotle's politics is like that, it's certainly not very libertarian individualist. However, there's a different interpretation from that of Popper or Edward Seller and George Grote, which is given in a book that came out in 1995 by Fred Miller. It's one of the outstanding books, I think, on Aristotle, called Nature, Justice, and Rights in Aristotle. And he argues that Aristotle did have a notion of individual rights. And the way he's arguing from about is just in the way we mentioned before. He said, well, Aristotle's talking about how each individual can attain the best life, how he can organize his life rationally. And it's true, he doesn't say we should have a libertarian society, but he does have the notion of the individual good, how each individual should try to be happy, so does at least have a notion of rights in that sense, because he would say it's true we individuals have to live in the city, but the reason we do individuals should have to live in the city is that this is for their individual good. And Roderick Long, who some of you may have read in his current lecture, also holds this view and wrote an article reviewing Miller's book in Review of Metaphysics in June 1996. There was a symposium on Miller's book in that journal. So the argument that Miller would give, so the individualist way of looking at Aristotle, is if each person is seeking the best life, then you can't really hold individuals that should subordinate himself totally to the state, because that wouldn't, why would that be best for you to subordinate yourself completely to the state? So if you take, according to Miller, if you take what Aristotle is saying, taking seriously what he says in the Ethics, then you'll see he's not a collectivist, but he's in really some species of individualist, even if not a libertarian of the strict observance. But how can Miller answer the objection we considered a while ago, which is, doesn't Aristotle say the individual is part of the city, just like the hand is part of the body? Doesn't this sound pretty collectivist? So what Miller said is, when Aristotle compares persons to parts, all he means is that people need external goods that not just that they get from themselves, such as friends or other people, in order to live well. So Miller says, and Aristotle's talked about the individual as part of the city, all he means is you need other people and activities in order to live well. But he's not suggesting there's some kind of superorganism that the individual is part of. And so it's really the city is something like a body, and then individuals are just cells of the body, so the individuals really don't count. Miller says, no, that's not what Aristotle is saying. So the polis on this view, that Miller's interpretation, is just a complete community we need in order to live a good life. Now, this isn't, although it's not a collectivist view, it's not an individualist, it's a libertarian view, because he says, according to this view of Aristotle, one of the advantages we have of living in a city-state is that other people can stop us from giving into passion and acting badly. And that isn't just if we try to violate other people's libertarian rights. The state can stop us from doing various bad things. So it's not a libertarian view, but on the other hand, it's not one that says, well, individuals don't count, they should just subordinate themselves to the state, because in this view, the polis, the city, is to the advantage of the people living in it. Now, well, if we say, well, the polis is the advantage of the individual, we still have to ask, well, what kind of polis, what kind of city-state are we talking about? And Aristotle thinks there's a best constitution or structure of polis, but that isn't the only one he talks about. He also considers what's best under various conditions, like what's the best one that we could put into practice under various conditions, which might not be identical with the best possible one in any of all circumstances. It might be what is the best one we can put into effect under various conditions. So his basic division when it's considering types of constitution, remember the constitution, you don't mean a written document, but just a sort of a systematic statement of the basic principles of how the city is organized. So there's good ones and bad ones. And the criterion for the good ones is they aim at benefiting everybody in the city. And the bad ones are those that aim at benefiting only some, like those would say benefit one class of people at the expense of other classes. So the good ones are kingship, which is ruled by one, aristocracy ruled by a few, and polity. Now polity is like democracy, which is we supposedly have today ruled by the majority. But Aristotle considers democracy on the bad side because he takes democracy to be rule on behalf of the poor. So the difference between polity and democracy, they're both majority rule city-states, but in the polity, the people are concerned with what's good for everybody. But in democracy, the majority is just concerned with what is good for us, namely those of us in the majority that don't care, say, about the rich people. Say, well, the rich people are just there. We should just take them, take what we can from them. So that would not be a good constitution, Aristotle says, because people aren't aiming the good of all. And the bad ones are tyranny, oligarchy, and democracy. So tyranny, again, ruled by one, oligarchy, ruled by a few, and democracy, ruled by many. But the difference between the good ones and the bad ones, again, is whether the system, the regime, aims at the good of everybody or just one faction. So the ideally best system he thinks is kingship, but he thinks that's very unlikely, because it's very unlikely to get somebody with the wisdom to be able to rule over everybody. Wisdom, so it's very hard to get kingship as opposed to tyranny if you have one person in charge. Now another good system is one where everybody's virtuous and people take turns ruling. So imagine everybody's virtuous, but they just have small groups who take turn ruling, and then another group of virtuous people take over. So a basic principle, how is aristocracy different than oligarchy? Well, aristocracy, again, it's ruled by a few, but the few are concerned with the good of everybody. So the aristocrats are not saying, well, what, let's just rule according to what's good for us, the aristocrat. They're saying what's good for everybody. But oligarchy, the few are just saying, well, how can, what's good for us? So a basic principle that Aristotle has is that people who are inferior in virtue should never rule over those superior in virtue. So it is the system that he says a good system where everybody is virtuous and people take turns ruling. No one who's inferior in virtue would be ruling over anyone superior. So in this kind of regime where everybody's virtuous and you have just small groups that take turns, that's an aristocracy in the sense that there are few ruling at each particular time, but it's more democratic than polity, which is ruled by majority, because in this system, everybody takes turns ruling. It's just you have a few people ruling at each time, so it's an aristocracy, but everybody takes turns, so that way more democratic than polity. Now, Aristotle, among the non-libertarian measures and favors, he thinks that there should be public education to get everybody to be virtuous, and there also has to be compulsory common meal, because this is the way you develop the civic spirit, and deformed babies, say if you have a baby that has various birth defects, you have to expose it, which means leave it out to be, can't take it home and feed it, you just have to leave it out, it would die. So he's definitely not a libertarian. He's like, you have a great responsibility to the whole city, because everybody's supposed to be virtuous, and I guess he thought that if you have certain birth defects, you wouldn't be able to develop in a virtuous way. Now, he also has some role for slavery. He talks about slaves by nature, and a slave by nature is someone who isn't controlled by reason. Say, supposing somebody's totally dominated by his passions, he just can't control himself. So Aristotle thinks those people would be better off if they were ruled by others. Although sometimes he says that even if you do have slaves, they should still be offered the prospect of freedom. Now, there's one view of Aristotle, which is held by Leo Strauss. Remember I mentioned him, like in that very controversial historian of political philosophy, who says, well, when Aristotle talks about slaves by nature, he's really attacking slavery. And this sounds a bit odd, but why would he say that? So, well, if you say a slave is someone who isn't in control of is let his passions control him, isn't controlled by reason, you wouldn't be able to say that actually existing slaves are necessarily slaves by nature. Maybe they're perfectly rational, so Aristotle would be saying, those people shouldn't be slaves. So in this view, just kind of a minority interpretation, Aristotle really was making somewhat of a criticism of slavery, but that isn't the way most people take it. Now, in Aristotle's city, ordinary workers, remember they're not slaves, can't become citizens. Why not? Because remember, very important that people live according to reason, and to really develop your rationality, you have to require leisure. So if you're working all day, you won't have leisure for rationality, so you can't really be a citizen. And a view that Aristotle had was that production, where you're making things outside of yourself, is inferior to thinking, in which the product of the activity, your thought, can't be separated from the activity itself. So you remember when I was talking about how you're arranging, thinking about how the goods, ultimate goods you're arranged, is the highest good. So as you remember there, you're thinking about the good just is the good. So your thinking isn't really separated from the good. It's the very thinking is the good. That's making sense. So Aristotle said, well, in production, you're making stuff outside yourself. Say you're building a house or a car, so that's different from you. But in thought, the product of thought is really not able to be separated from the activity. So we thought that was higher. Now, there's a problem here in that, suppose you just leave the slaves out. Well, if you say ordinary workers can't be citizens, how could you say that Aristotle really believes in individual rights? Because presumably the workers wouldn't like the fact they're in an inferior position. So if he's to get around this and avoid despotism, he would have to say that the workers would have to consent to this arrangement. They'd have to say, well, you know, we recognize that since we don't have enough leisure to think, we shouldn't be citizens. That seems somewhat unlikely. So the last thing I want to talk about is Aristotle's views on private property. Remember, Plato thought that for the guardians, and also the auxiliaries, who were the guardians of the philosopher king, the auxiliaries are the ones who helped them out by enforcing what they say, they shouldn't have any private property. So in Book Two of the Politics, Aristotle argues against it. Says, well, you need like private twice, I guess it's really private if you put it twice. So he said, people need private property in order to express yourself. Suppose, say, I wanted to say something, but I didn't have any means of writing anything down or speaking in public. I didn't own a computer. I couldn't get my views out. I wouldn't be able to express myself unless I own something. And he also says, people want property. People love themselves. We want things for ourselves. So we need property for that reason. We want to get things just because we're trying to do things for our own advantage, or the advantage of those we love, so we want to have property for that reason. And he has a very unusual argument for property. He says, well, one virtue we have is to be generous, say, to give gifts to people, to do things for other people. But we can't do that. We can't be generous unless we own property. So to say, attack Plato's proposal for common property for the guardians. However, once more, he's not full libertarian, because he said, there should be limits on how much property you can amass in a union that people get. There are two great disparities between people, say some people are extremely wealthy and some others are very poor. He thinks that's a bad idea. So I think I'll stop now, and we can now open the Q&A box so you can type your questions in the Q&A or comments, objections, or also in the chat. I'll look in both, but I'm going to open the Q&A now. And Roger says, what is Aristotle's definition of polity once again? Well, polity is rule by the majority of people. So it's like democracy, which is majority rule, but in polity, the people are concerned with what's good for everybody. So see, remember the crucial distinction, the good regimes are the ones where the rulers are concerned with whoever they are concerned with what's good for everybody. So in a polity, you have ruled by a majority, but the majority isn't just saying, well, what's good for us, meaning the people in the majority, but they're saying what's good for everybody. Now, George says, Eric von Kuhnau was being claimed by Plato and Aristotle as a monarchist, be sympathetic. Is this correct? If it is, how so exactly? Are there arguments in it? Any very small compliment indirectly supplement or merely that I don't tangentially add to the arguments of Hans Hoppen on monarchy versus democracy. Kuhnau, Levine's claim in any case seems like an interesting topic to explore here, at least I believe so. Well, for those of you who know me, you know, not a name dropper, can you guess what I'm going to say? Anybody want to guess what my first comment will be on Eric von Kuhnau would be? Knowing me, what am I going to say? Anybody want to guess that? No clue. Oh, I'm going to say, I knew Eric von Kuhnau would be. I used to talk to him. And see, what he said, I mean, there's something to what he said. Remember, Aristotle says kingship is really the ideally best form of government. He thinks it's very unlikely we're going to get that. I mean, Aristotle says, I had Plato once ruled by the philosopher kings. I suppose you could have a case where there's only one person who's the philosopher king. But I think Kuhnau Levine is going too far in saying that they favor monarchy, but you could take them in a way where they're thinking monarchy is the best, is one of the forms that could be best, I think. Now, the argument on top of gives is a bit different. He thinks that the monarch is one, since he's interested in continuity of the regime, he's not going to be thrown out of power. He can act more in the long-term interests of the people. He doesn't have to be concerned with retaining the favor of the people. So that would come in as a bit like Aristotle thinking that a good regime is one that acts for the best interests of everyone, not just for a faction. So I think it's a bit different, though, in that Aristotle doesn't say, well, having one person in control is going to make it more likely that that person is acting for the general interest. So I'd have to check, I don't think he really gives exactly that argument. But there is similarity in that there are things that Hoppe says and Kuhnau, that Aristotle Plato says you could take as sympathetic to monarchy. Although remember, of course, Hans favors a stateless society as best one. Now, Trent says, don't both play to an aerosol committal logical fallacy and assuming any group of people can be trusted to rule with their separate best interests at heart. Any empirical evidence for this ever? Well, it may be, I think there, see, it wouldn't, if they wrongly assume this, it wouldn't be a logical fallacy. It might be a mistake in the view that they have. But they're not really committed to saying that, in fact, it's the case that there have been good governments. They're really just trying to say, what are the conditions for a good government? Now, they, you do find both in the Republic, you find the Republic, after Plato sets up the ideal city, he discusses how it can degenerate, and he thinks it will degenerate, say, by having factions take it over and rule in their own interests. And I think Aristotle has the view that it's very unlikely you could get the ideal city. So I think they're alive to the issue you're raising. Now, Samuel says, does his idea of kingship apply to a particular individual any time that it's more fit to rule than all others? Yes, it would, because remember, his principle is, at least it would imply that the person is, there's no, let me modify what you said, it would imply that there's no one more fit than the king to rule, because his principle is no one who's inferior in virtue can rule somebody who's superior. I suppose you could have a case where, say, there are some people who are tied for most virtues, but one of them happens to be the king. So as long as that person was proper and virtuous and no one was better than him, I think he could still be king in Aristotle's terms. Even though there were people equally virtuous, and wasn't more fit to rule than anyone else. Now, Jay says, so wouldn't an ideal aristocracy just be a kingship? No, because a kingship would imply usually just one person in charge, although there have been cases where there are two kings, like in Sparta, it's always governed by two kings. But an ideal aristocracy, in the way Aristotle gave it, everybody's equal and virtuous, and people take turns ruling, groups of people take turns ruling. So it wouldn't have to be a kingship. Again, remember, if you say that no one, if you have the ruler, has to be at least as virtuous as anyone in the city, there can't be someone more virtuous who's being ruled by someone less virtuous. It doesn't follow from that that you can't have someone who's virtuous ruling people who are as virtuous as he is. You see, different. One is saying something like, you can't have a bad person ruling a good person. It doesn't follow from that you can't have a good person ruling over someone who's also good or who's as good. And George, on Plato, you said that Plato didn't believe that individuals had rights against the state. But that seems to still be one question, if men have rights at all from his point of view. Thus, the question I remain, did Plato believe in any kind of rights? For example, simply to be treated justly might be considered a right, and hence men do have rights. Well, that's a very good question. I think Plato certainly thought that everyone ought to be treated justly, but he doesn't suggest that if someone doesn't treat you justly, you would have a right to use force against him. He seems to be suggesting that in the ideal city, it would be up to the guardians to set up the proper rules for proceeding. So you would only be able to proceed against those who treated you unjustly if the government allowed that. So I don't think you would be able to say, the basic thing there wouldn't follow from saying people ought to be treated justly, that people have a right in the sense of the enforceable claim to be treated justly. Now, Jay says, could you explain again how policy differs from democracy? Okay, this is one I see I should go over again. People seem to have a bit of difficulty with it. Remember, the basic thing that Aristotle is doing, you have to first remember it before you start thinking about different regimes, you know, policy, democracy, tyranny, kingship. You have to remember the basic division is good ones and bad ones. Good ones are those that aim at the good of everybody. Bad ones are those that aim at just a particular faction. So then you have, within each of those classes, you have ruled by one, a few, or many. So you have ruled by one, ruled by a few, ruled by many. And polity is rule, the good one that's ruled by many. Democracy is the bad one that's ruled by many. And what makes it good or bad? Well, in polity, the majority, the many, are concerned not just with what's good for the many, but what's good for everybody. Say, suppose you have the majority are just middle class or poor people. They're not going to say, well, let's really loot the rich, forget about them. They're going to be saying what's good for everybody. But in democracy, as Plato is conceiving it, the many are just concerned with what's good for the many. Now, Samuel says, probably is less extension of oneself, the requirement for like more means to happen. But I think it's both, actually. You're developing yourself, it's part of your self-expression, and it's a way you can achieve gratification also. So it's part of your self-love, and also your expression, that extension of self, and also a way of being generous to others. Now, George says, what are the similarities and differences between political philosophy of Aristotle and Aquinas? Well, and of course, I gave 5 years ago at the Museum Institute, I gave a whole lecture on Aquinas. So Aquinas really, remember, he wrote a commentary on Aristotle. He was very Aristotelian, but remember, in Aquinas, they're not just concerned with the earthly city, what's good for people living their lives on earth, but all this is subordinate to the laws of God. So it's in Aquinas, this is all embedded within a theological framework. Now, you see, but there are very strong similarities. Now, Jay says, from a libertarian perspective, policy would be similar to the idea of a small, unobtrusive government. Not necessarily, no. See, it's not the size of the government that Aristotle is concerned with, but what is it that the government is aiming at? Is it aiming at the good of everybody or just the good of the rulers? So let's just take an example. Suppose you have a single ruler. So you say, well, is this single ruler aiming just at what's good for him, or is he aiming at what's good for everybody? If he's aiming at what's good for everybody, then that's an example of kingship. But if he's aiming at what's good for himself, that's tyranny. So the polity, it's ruled by the many, but they're aiming at the good for everybody. Now, Jacob says it's possible for a state to make everyone better off if the state does not have goods of its own external to the population. It necessarily has to take from someone else in order to make another better off. Can a good constitution exist? Now, that's a very good question. But see, I think Aristotle would say there would be two things we could say there. Of course, your Jacob is certainly good from a libertarian point of view if you say, well, people have property rights, it's wrong to take from some to others. So what Aristotle is saying is he's not saying that you can't do something that makes one person better off to the disadvantage of someone else. He's saying that's what we call the Pareto rule, you know, something that changes Pareto superior if it makes at least one person better off and doesn't make anyone else worse off. So Aristotle isn't giving a version of the Pareto criteria. He's saying that what the ruler has to do is to consider what's for everybody's good. But it doesn't follow that when he considers that, it has to mean that he can't rearrange anything to help one person make somebody else not as well off as he was before. It's not you can't shift anyone's position in a way that he comes out not as good as he was before, but it's that you have to take everybody's interest into account. So supposing, say, you thought some people were too rich and they should have money taken away from them. So what Aristotle would say is you can't just say, well, this would help the poor if you take money away from the rich and give it to the poor. You'd also have to say, well, let's consider what would be good for the rich people also, but you could come up with a conclusion that it's better, all things considered, to take from the rich and give to the poor. But the difference is you have to take into account everybody's interests. You see, it doesn't follow that you can't worsen everybody. That's an excellent question. Let's see, now there's one, we're about out of time, but I see there's somebody else who has a question. Let me just look at this. Aristotle says that there's a certain difference is found among ends. Some activities, others products apart from the activities that produce them. Where there are ends apart from the actions, the nature of products to be better than the activities. This seems akin to Menger's insight that higher order goods derive their value from lower order goods. In that the lower goods are better than higher order goods. I see. Yes, you're quite right that if you're producing something, if you're making something, then you're doing it in order to achieve something else. So the goal is more important than the activity, in the sense that you're making a table, and the table is more important than the activity. But remember, Aristotle was saying that there's another class of activities where you're not able to separate the end or the goal from the activity, and those are better than these other activities where you do have that separation. So that's kind of un-Mengelian. Now, Trent says, as Aristotle mentioned, who gets to define life for the good of everybody? Is it not impossible to have a policy that's good for everybody due to different people's values on field? Well, that's kind of a Hayekian point. But Aristotle doesn't take that. Remember, Aristotle thinks it's just a matter of fact what's good or bad for people. So people could have different views about it, but he would say, well, some people are wrong about this. So the fact that their difference of opinion wouldn't rule out what he wants. Remember, it's not a libertarian way of thinking about things. Now, Lenin and Aristotle, is the rule supposed to be executive maker and judge of laws? Were these functions separating the Greek polis? Well, they were in Athens. I mean, you had, say, the assembly was both the lawmaker and judge, although there were certain kind of courts were independent of full assembly. But it was really kind of executing law was really done kind of by private people. There was no real public police force. And for Aristotle, this would, how these functions would be separate would just depend on the particular regime. There would be differences for different regimes on who, it wouldn't be, it would vary with different kinds of government, how these functions of government were divided. Well, okay, I guess we're about out of time now, so thanks very much, everybody. I hope to see you all. Now, Jay asked, what do you think of Aristotle? Well, I mean, he was one of the great philosophers. He wasn't always right. He had some interesting, important insights. He's one of the great figures. I mean, I don't have anything really, really certainly one you have to read. I don't think I could say anything especially illuminating, say, but what I think of him. Just one, you know, one of the greats is one you have to study. Okay, well, thanks everybody. Hope to see you all next week. Next week we're going to talk about Hobbes. Okay, thanks everybody. Bye bye. Thanks.